fashion to the Laurier Golden Hawks. Now the Gaels find themselves in the role of the Road Warriors, traveling to Laurier's home turf, hungry for revenge. Who will prevail in this clash of Vanier Cup contenders? On Saturday, tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM or CFRC.ca to catch all the pulse-pounding action. The CFRC pregame show will begin at 12:45 p.m. with a 1 p.m. scheduled kickoff time. We hope you'll join us for this classic clash between two powerhouse programs.
Homecoming isn't just for alumni, it's for the whole Kingston community. Join us Saturday, October 20th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for the Fall Harvest Gathering at Agnes Benedictson Field. Enjoy live music, face painting, lawn games, and the flavors of Kingston's finest food trucks. Plus, explore a pop-up vendor market featuring local artisans. This free outdoor event celebrates the season and brings together friends, family, and community. Visit queensu.ca/alumni/homecoming for more info.
Good morning, it is 11 a.m. and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. The future of the Sleeping Cabin program, recently rebranded as the Crossroads Village Project, is currently uncertain after Our Livable Solutions, OLS, announced that the initiative has been placed on hold due to a loss of operational funding. It was announced in fall 2023 that the project would wind down by September 30th, 2024. In July, the project made a major comeback, OLS managing to secure their own operational funding and a permanent location for a cabin community courtesy of Crossroads United Church, and council agreeing to cover costs for the development of the site and sell OLS the cabins for $1. A collapse in the agreement between OLS and their operational funding source has halted progress on this relocation, which was intended to ensure stability for residents as the program transitioned. All OLS staff have received notices of the end of their employment on September 30th, 2024. The City of Kingston released a statement in response to this announcement, reiterating its commitment to support the project with the agreed-upon July arrangement of selling the cabins to OLS for $1 and providing $500,000 for their site preparation and capital development expenses, as well as assisting in finding housing in the meantime for current cabin residents. As Kingston grapples with a growing housing crisis, over 633 individuals currently experiencing homelessness, OLS is currently working with the city to provide housing solutions to the 11 current cabin residents ahead of the program's planned wind down by September 30th. I sat down with Executive Director of OLS, Crystal Wilson, to speak about the current state of the project and what comes next. OLS has announced the Crossroads Village project is now on hold, the reason being operating funds falling through for OLS. I was wondering if you could expand upon how this ended up happening and the factors at play here.
So I guess it's a longer timeline. So last November, Homestead and through Brett Smith had generously offered a location that they weren't using called Arena Marina. And we were expecting to go there. The donation was over $900,000, which included all the buildup plus some operating costs for 3 years. And unfortunately, the city declined that offer. And when they declined it, they also chose to wind down the pilot project we've been running. And then again in April, we went back to City Council and they chose again to wind down the program. So our standard source of operating funds was gone. And then there was a partnership with a private donor, but that's fallen through. So without that, we need to be able to pay our staff, right? And so we're working on some new partnerships, and it's looking pretty hopeful. We're very hopeful that we'll be able to open before winter, but it'll be because of private donors and foundations that helping us out if it works out. In general, the three levels of government, what ends up happening is a nonprofit group will try to launch an initiative to get people housed or, you know, run food programs or whatever. And often what happens is you'll get capital costs, but not the appropriate amount or any operating costs. And the governments leave it up to the nonprofits to find that money, whether it's through donations or through foundations or, you know, grant writing all the time. And it makes it really difficult on the groups that are trying to stay focused on the work they're trying to do. Because our job is to bring people into transition housing and stabilize them and help them get ready for permanent housing. But if we're spending all of our time chasing money, it's a lot of energy that we're not putting into the people that we support. And then all of the liability for these activities gets put on the nonprofits as well. This is across the board. So it's not just us paying. It's just the way the government functions in terms of, providing housing. It ends up being the housing providers constantly chasing money, trying to find, and we're all competing for the same dollars, right? It would be much more helpful if the three levels of government could come up with a way to provide stable revenue for the nonprofits to provide housing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to tack on the end there, I was wondering if you could provide a statement about the partnership that fell through.
It's a tough one. I would just say that the partnership has fallen through.
So where are cabin residents at right now? What happens after that September 30th wind down deadline now that we don't have Crossroads Village to look forward to right at the deadline?
Mm-hmm. So, we've all been working really hard. The city's been facilitating lots of conversations with local housing providers and service providers. We were hoping for the Canada-Ontario Housing Benefit to become available because it's normally open for funding for new applications May 1st. And unfortunately, the Ford government has not opened it for new applications yet. So we were hoping that would open and to be able to move people to market housing, but it hasn't happened. We kept waiting for that. And then, so now the local service providers have stepped up and provided space within their agencies to accommodate most of the people. So we moved somebody this morning, somebody else moved last week. We still have 10 to worry about. Most of them have pretty good plans in place. We're just firming up. We're just firming up the housing situations. And when people are moving into those options. And then the city is going to be providing funding for hotel stays until those housing options are available.
Okay, that's good to know that there's something in the interim.
We've all done our best, the city and NOLS and the service provider, find ways to be able to accommodate people in an overcrowded system already, to find ways to accommodate all of our residents. It's not all of the housing is 100% ideal, but it gives them a roof over their head until they can find more permanent housing. So we're hopeful that just keeping them stable and not sending them back to the streets will help move them into permanent housing eventually.
Yeah, and you might not be able to say, but who are some of those service providers who are providing support during this time?
The standard ones, it's Lion's Heart and Home-Based Housing, Dawn House. One of our residents found market housing on their own, so that was great.
Sounds good. And how many residents do you have currently?
As of today, we have 9 that are here. One unfortunately is in the hospital right now, but and then we have to worry about that person's situation once we know what's going on with them. But we have 9 in the cabins right now.
You mentioned that you do have expectations that you might be able to move forward with Crossroads Village in the winter. What's sort of on the horizon for OLS? Are there partnerships that you're looking forward to, or any folks who've stepped forward with donations? What kind of makes you hope that you'll be able to open in the winter?
I think we've had some really great conversations, and we're really hopeful that some of them will come through. Whether it's one organization or person stepping up to support us to start out, or it's a combination of organizations. It looks like it'll end up being a combination of places to get us moving forward. We're having really good conversations, so I'm hopeful. And then for our common building that has bathrooms and showers and the kitchen shared facilities, the manufacturer of our cabins has stepped up and is going to be providing the common building at a significantly reduced, like they're eating a lot of the cost of it. Mm-hmm. So we'll be well under budget for capital expenditures. It's going to be built in Niagara Falls, and then they'll be able to put it together really quickly. They just ship it down in four sections and then piece it together in Kingston. So once we can prepare the site in terms of excavating for utilities and doing all the electrical hookup and stuff, the common building can be put together in a matter of a couple of days.
That's great. Yeah. And I was wondering if you could give us a bit of a vague timeline in terms of getting the site excavated and actually being fully set up at Crossroads United Church.
So we originally had planned for a 6-week start from shovels in the ground to done. Mm-hmm. But because of what Modular Energy Systems is offering, we can actually speed that up quite a bit. So it should be only be a couple of weeks of site preparation, and then the main building comes in. We should be ready to go. So, which is why we're hopeful that we can get open before winter. So as long as we can excavate before winter, then we should be able to open in the winter or before the winter. Yeah. If we don't get the funding in place before the winter starts, we won't be able to do the excavation. So we'll have to wait until the spring then.
The recent release from the city also notably accused OLS of spreading misinformation, stating, quote, "We are also disheartened to hear misinformation circulated by OLS, placing blame on the city for not financially supporting the cabin program." When asked for clarification on this statement by CFRC, the city responded, quote, "The misinformation we refer to was OLS stating that the city withdrew funding on the project, which is incorrect. The city did not commit to operating funds, but did commit capital funding totaling $500,000 for their site preparation and capital development expenses related to a common amenities building, accessible sidewalks, and ramps. Should OLS secure the necessary operating funds within the 2-year period approved by council," end quote. Crystal commented on this and the clarification provided to CFRC.
And I guess I'm pretty confused by that, because we did send our media release to saying that we're putting the project on hold. The city was well aware through meetings that it was going to end up being put on hold, that we had lost the partnership. And so I'm pretty confused by that statement, because in our media release, we very clearly said the city's contributing capital costs, and it's the partnership with the operating costs that had fallen apart.
As stated by Crystal, OLS has hopes that the project will be up and running before the winter. This has been Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter with CFRC News. The Kingston Climate Justice Coalition, a newly formed group made up of various environmental advocacy organizations in the city, will be launching with a Kingston Climate Action Town Hall on Saturday, September 28th. Down with Eric McBay, lead on climate justice at Providence Center and founding member of KCJC, to talk about the formation of the coalition, the town hall this weekend, and the Kingston City Council report card. The Kingston Climate Justice Coalition is a relatively new group, if I'm not mistaken. What's the story there? Who's involved, and how did it all come together?
Yeah, the Kingston Climate Justice Coalition is new, and so it really emerged out of some discussions earlier this year around advocacy on climate issues to Kingston City Council. As you may know, Kingston's climate leadership plan calls for both the municipality and the community at large to be carbon neutral by the year 2040. But there have been a number of delays on important actions to make that happen. And one of the things we heard at a share a report card on the state of climate action in Kingston.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you for that background. And we'll get into the City Council report card, which I believe is a big piece of this event. But before that, we've seen rallies, protests, celebrations, galas hosted by our community climate action groups. What was the decision-making process behind making this a town hall event?
So we really wanted it to be as participatory and as inclusive as possible. Mm-hmm. I think for me, one of the most important things that I see in organizing around climate justice is that it affects every single part of our lives, right? It affects the kind of food that we can eat and where it comes from. It affects the cost of living. Increasingly, it affects immigration and refugees. The United Nations predicts that by the year 2050, there will be more than 1.2 billion people displaced by climate change. And so it's a very urgent problem that affects everyone, but it also affects everyone in different ways, right? And that's one of the reasons that we wanted to identify climate justice as a priority and not just climate change in general or climate action. It's important to recognize that, you know, people who have a lot of power or wealth or privilege, they're affected by climate change in different ways than people who have less kind of status. One of the issues that we care about, for example, is adequate temperatures in residences and rental units. So many people who are in rental units don't have enough insulation. They don't have enough. They don't have air conditioning, and so during heat waves, they might be at risk of heat problems, especially people who are senior citizens. And so the reason we wanted to have this climate town hall was to really give a chance to represent the different overlapping issues that groups have, but also for people to come and share their own concerns and share their own visions for what Kingston could look like in 2040 and beyond.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you. And introducing the Kingston City Council report card, I was wondering if you could speak to the reasoning behind this document. I know our Chamber of Commerce did a similar thing last year. Is it going to look like that? What's this document going to look like and provide for our community?
Yeah, so we are going to unveil this document on Saturday, but I will say that this report card is really the result of doing a lot of work with nonprofit organizations, with members of the coalition, with independent experts to analyze the city of Kingston's track record of action and inaction on the climate crisis. And so the report itself is broken down into different categories like climate targets and accountability, transportation, vulnerable peoples, the built environment, and we've identified where Kingston's making progress, but also where it's fallen short of some of its commitments in the scientific consensus on action. So the report card is very concise, and it identifies really a very brief summary of the status in each of these areas and some of the actions that we want to see for the city to maybe get a better grade, for example. And so we've identified areas where the city is very promising, but also some areas where its actions are inadequate or even harmful. And so we wanted to use the report card approach because climate change is such a complicated and multifaceted issue, right? It's really easy to get lost in the weeds or for people to get confused by all of the different kinds of action, by different regulations, by different organizations and bureaucracies that are at play. And so we wanted to really summarize in a concise way that people could see at a glance the status of climate action in terms of the municipality, in terms of the city of Kingston's actions. And the intent is that this is going to be the first annual report, that this will be an ongoing kind of report card. And it will hopefully offer some guidance for people in the community, but also for city council and staff to prioritize some action that that is urgent, I think, at this point in history.
Awesome. Yeah. And you got into this a bit in that answer there. I imagine you're keeping a lot of your findings under wraps as you prepare to present on Saturday. But what can you tell us right now as we approach the event about what Kingstonians will be able to take away from this new report?
I think that people will be able to take away a few different things. Mm-hmm. On one hand, you know, there are areas where I think Kingston is doing a legitimately good job. And I think it's worth celebrating. And there, I mean, there are a lot of people working very hard on climate change, both in the kind of city organization within the city structure and people like climate champions and community groups. I also think there are some really important areas where the city is falling behind. And, you know, we live at a very critical moment in history where we, the decisions that we make in the next few years, in the next few decades, will actually shape the lives and experiences and well-being of people, not just in Kingston, not just in Canada, but all around the world for decades or even centuries. And so it's really important, I think, to speak honestly and identify places that that we can do better as a community and that the city can do better in order to maximize the health and well-being and safety of people here and around the world. I think another thing that people might take away is that, you know, we really already have most of the technologies that we need to address climate change. Sometimes there's this idea that, oh, you know, that we need to wait for some kind of hypothetical breakthrough or we need fusion power or something. And that's really not the case. We already have most of the technologies that we need to adjust to address the climate crisis. It's just a matter of putting into place those actions in a timely way. And lastly, I hope that people will take away is a feeling of possibility and a desire to participate more. So we have some presentations. We have some excellent speakers. So Kyla Tienhara, who's a professor at Queen's University, the chair, Canada Research Chair in Economy and Environment, is going to be speaking. Christine Sipnowich, the co-chair of the Coalition of Kingston Communities, is going to be speaking. There will be people speaking about, really, in a constructive way, the kinds of actions that we can take to move forward. But we're also going to set aside, a bunch of time, about the last hour or so. It's really going to be small group discussions about these themed areas, facilitated by experts in those areas. So we're going to be inviting people to talk about what they would envision Kingston looking like in 2040, the things that they want to see happen and the things that they want to participate in. So, you know, this is really a constructive way of moving forward and prioritizing action. And so ultimately, I want to see people coming away from the town hall with a sense of hope for the change that is possible to make in our community.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you mentioned you foresee this being an annual report.
Yeah, I expect this will continue for some time. I think that it's really critical to have, to have an organization like the Kingston Climate Justice Coalition. And it's important to, to give feedback, and whether that's recognizing good work or highlighting areas where maybe there's some improvements that need to happen. Climate change is not going to be solved overnight, and it's not even going to be solved in 1 or 2 years. It is something that's going to take many years to solve. And I think an organization like the Kingston Climate Justice Coalition has a really important role in kind of elevating community voices, but also being an independent third party, right? I think that when the city releases a budget report, that's reviewed by third-party auditors who make sure that everything is correct and clear. We don't have a mechanism for doing that for climate action or for carbon budgeting. But I think we really need something like that. And I think it's very important to have independent kind of third-party organizations that are accountable to the grassroots, accountable to the community, that can speak to the issues of great importance for people in Kingston and in the entire world.
Once again, that was Eric McBay, lead of climate justice at Providence Center, on the upcoming town hall this weekend, hosted by the Kingston Climate Justice Coalition. To learn more about the coalition and the Kingston Climate Action Town Hall taking place at City Hall on Saturday, you can search Kingston Climate Justice Coalition or visit their page on Eventbrite. This has been Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter with CFRC News.
The Kingston Film Heritage Project and Vulnerable Media Lab have partnered to bring a Home Movie Day event to Kingston in October. Home Movie Day has been an annual celebration of home movies and immature films held at venues worldwide since 2003. Started by a group of film archivists concerned about what would happen to all the home movies shot on film during the 20th century. The event gives community members an opportunity to see their films on the big screen, as well as have their memories digitized for free. Home Movie Day events also often include tips for preserving films. It was announced that Saturday, October 19th, will be the inaugural event for Kingston, taking place at the Screening Room. All proceeds for this event will also be going towards All Our Relations Land Trust, a charitable organization led by Indigenous peoples committed to supporting and protecting the environment in the Kingston area. The theme for films this year is transience. To learn more about this first-time event for the city, CFRC sat down with organizer Adam Cook. Here is a bit of that conversation. This year, the Kingston Film Heritage Project and Vulnerable Media Lab announced Home Movie Day 2024. So this has been kind of a named event since early 2000s. What is Home Movie Day?
Yeah, Home Movie Day started over 20 years ago. Basically, a group of film archivists were concerned about what was going to happen to all the home movies shot on film specifically during the 20th century, a kind of concern that we share at the Vulnerable Media Lab, which is housed in the Film and Media Department at Queen's. And it's an annual event held around the world with different participating cities where local home movies are exhibited for a public audience. This is the inaugural edition in Kingston, and we're really excited to be the ones hosting the first ever Home Movie Day in Kingston.
Yeah, awesome. What was sort of the inspiration to bring it to Kingston, and how are you and your team feeling about spearheading this inaugural year?
Yeah, well, it comes naturally to us working in the Vulnerable Media Lab, which is a state-of-the-art historic media transfer remediation and restoration research lab. Basically, we scan, digitize, and restore various media, including celluloid film, but not limited to it, mini DV tapes, VHS, et cetera, et cetera. So we're always looking to embark on new projects internally at the lab, but also curatorially. We like to, engage with the public, engage with Kingston, and specifically with the Kingston Film Heritage Project, which we've been running for some months now. We're looking to engage with the city's history, archival materials of the city, and now in the case of Home Movie Day, material produced by locals or people living here. It's okay if they're just passing through, too. Our theme for the first edition is transience.
Yeah, for sure. And could you get into that theme a little bit, transience? What was the choice there, and what does that mean exactly?
Well, what it means is something that we're happy to leave to the interpretation of those curious about submitting. Transience, of course, could really be used to describe home movies and vulnerable media in general. Of course, the temporary nature of things, of material, but also the passage of time. Home movies are typically linked with nostalgia, so it seemed fitting to go with the theme of transience, but we wanted to keep it as open-ended as possible to let the folks who might have some home movies up in their attic or whatever that they want to dig out, some creativity when they're thinking of submitting to us.
Awesome. Yeah. And you describe this media as vulnerable. And of course, it's in the title there, Vulnerable Media Lab. I was wondering if you could get into a bit of what that means.
Yeah, well, of course, I'm sure people kind of envision celluloid film, 16 millimeter, 35 millimeter, Super 8, what have you, as being vulnerable. We know that it deteriorates over time unless it's kept in really ideal conditions. We do have our own vault, our own archive in the Film and Media Department where we preserve a lot of different film. But actually, digital media is arguably just as vulnerable. It's a bit of a misnomer that it's celluloid film that is. So really, any kind of media, including contemporary forms of it, are all vulnerable to different forms of expiry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So I guess this event, yeah, it's about nostalgia, preservation. And yeah, are you hoping that this event will continue to be an annual thing in the future? Or are you guys just kind of rolling with it this year?
Well, ideally, yeah, I think it would be wonderful if this could be an annual event in Kingston and ongoing as part of the Kingston Film Heritage Project. What it actually turns out to be is really in the hands of the people listening to this right now. Submissions are open now, and we are open to anything, really. If people want information about how to submit their home movies, potentially have them digitized for their own posterity, and then potentially projected on the big screen, they can do so now. If they go to the Screening Room website, because that's where we will be hosting the screening, you'll find information there, or they can email me at 22AC18@queensu.ca for more information. So it's up to the people who submit their home movies what kind of content we'll get, and how much what the volume of submissions will be. Hopefully, it's popular. It's important to us to keep the barriers to a minimum for this event. So it is pay what you can, with proceeds going to a charity, All Our Relations Land Trust. And we'll be accepting submissions for the rest of the month, and then hosting the screening October 19th at 1 p.m. at the Screening Room.
Awesome. Yeah. And like you just said there, there's still quite a while to submit. Have you received any submissions so far? How's it looking?
Well, the submission process, we wanted to kind of make as easy as possible, both for those submitting and for ourselves. So submitting your home movie actually doesn't involve sharing your home movie with us. You just have to fill out a quick form. Honestly, it takes about 5 minutes to fill out. We just want to hear a little bit about what it is that you are thinking of submitting. And then based on that, we're going to contact a handful of people and get in touch with them about getting a hold of their home movies. And those are the ones that we'll digitize and project on October 19th.
Submissions for home movies to digitize and feature at the screening are being accepted until the end of September. You can visit screeningroomkingston.com for more details.
Why It's Possible, a show written by Kingston's Sophia Fabili, is set to make its world premiere at the Kingston Grand Theatre tonight. Directed by Evelyn Perry and featuring Zoe Sweet in the lead role, the production delves into the complexities of modern parenthood. The narrative centers around Beth, a 45-year-old single mother living in her mother's basement while juggling a demanding job and the challenges of parenthood, all while her child embarks on a journey of self-discovery and explores their gender identity. The story is grounded in Limestone City, being produced and set in Kingston. The team also collaborated with Trans Family Kingston, a local support group for families who have trans kids, members offering their insight throughout the writing process. I sat down with writer Sophia Fabili to chat about premiering her first play in Kingston as a Kingston native, and the journey leading up to this big night.
How long have you been writing Why It's Impossible, and how has it been leading up to this premiere week?
We've been working on this project for 4 years, so it's been a long process, and that's just kind of the pace of developing new work in Canada, seeking the grant funding, doing the script development process. But this week has been good. It's a kind of that busy tech week where we have long days and the designers are there and we're all kind of, it's a full court press. So, but things are really coming together and I'm really looking forward to opening on Friday.
Exciting. Yeah. And what can audiences expect? What are the kind of themes of the show?
Great question. I think audiences can expect a play that is about parenting in precarious times. The show is a one-woman show. It is about a mom, played by my brilliant colleague and collaborator, Zoe Sweet. And it is essentially her telling the story of raising a child who is exploring their gender identity. And so I don't think I'm spoiling too much, but basically the kind of heart of the show is that the mom is accepting of her kid's identity, but is struggling with the ways in which the world presents a lot of challenges to young people who are questioning things and exploring their identity. And so it's really about how does she kind of rise to the challenge of really supporting her kid. And I think audiences can expect, I like to write in a bit of like an irreverent tone. She talks right to the audience. The baby grand is very intimate space. So I think audiences can expect an intimate, hopefully sometimes funny, hopefully sometimes breaking, heartwarming, a little bit of everything. I would call it kind of a somewhere between comedy and drama, but that's what audiences can expect.
Awesome. Yeah. And I think it's so interesting that you started writing this 4 years ago because it feels so topical. And even like the month of September, it's like kids are going back to school. Parents are experiencing so many new things. We're in an election season and so many of these topics are coming up and it feels so current.
Absolutely. And we've often kind of commented that, you know, it felt very topical when we started exploring this, you know, this play 4 years ago. And it feels even more like a, I don't want to say hot topic issue, but something that is very much in everyone's minds. And certainly, you know, from the beginning, we really wanted to do this topic like thoughtful and careful justice in terms of writing a story that was very carefully researched. And so we've worked really closely with a couple of amazing folks from Trans Family Kingston, which is like a trans support group for families who have trans kids. And so anyways, they have been like collaborators and cheerleaders of us and have helped us research and read the script. And so anyways, we've tried really hard. It's a very complex topic and we wanted to bring a lot of care to that. So we've tried to do our best, but I think this is just, you know, one person's story. And ultimately we need so many more stories about this topic.
Yeah, absolutely. And for you writing this play, did it come from personal experience or was it just pulling from the cultural zeitgeist of things people were talking about? Where did you get this idea?
So the very beginning started with Zoe, myself, and our other colleague, Sarah Kitts, who's now also brilliant and is now the artistic director of their great Canadian theatre company in Ottawa, where we're actually bringing the play in the new year, which is very exciting. But the three of us, you know, in the pandemic, when all the theatres were closed, we all were in Kingston and Zoe was like, this is ridiculous. Like, we should be working. Let's make a play. And so we kind of started meeting in my backyard, socially distanced at a picnic table. Going, you know, what kind of story would be something if we could make our own play and craft our own story? What's something that we all really care about and are very curious about? So both Zoe and Sarah are moms of young kids. I hope to be a parent and I'm also a teacher. So I certainly, you know, have worked hard to be, you know, an ally in the school where queer kids and trans kids know that, you know, Miss Fab has a lot of like rainbow colored stuff in her classroom. So, you know, it's something that we all were kind of talking about. And the big question was, you know, how as a parent, you know, as a cisgendered parent, how do you be an incredible supportive force for your kid exploring their gender identity when, you know, when we were growing up, like these weren't really things that we went through personally, right? So that kind of generational divide and, so yeah, that was kind of where the conversation started. And then, of course, as we started getting into it, we quickly realized we wanted to get some local trans folks supporting us. And that's where Trans Family came in. And they have been such a beautiful force of like creativity and support. So I really give them a big shout out because I don't think the play would exist if we weren't able to work with them.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was just thinking, I was wondering if you could speak to just writing this in Kingston. And do you teach in Kingston as well?
I do teach in Kingston and I'm from Kingston originally, but I spent most of my like young, you know, university and about 10 years after that in Toronto. So I just moved back in the pandemic. So I've actually not had a play premiere here.
Oh, wow.
And so
okay.
Part of it was, you know, Zoe's also a Toronto transplant. And part of us was going, you know, we were going, we are calling Kingston home and a lot of new plays in Canada premiere in Toronto, you know, like that's kind of the place to try to get your play and other theaters too, but Toronto's a hot spot. And so we kind of had this goal of why can't we do a play premiere here? Can we build a play that is specifically for Kingston audiences? And so that has really been a driving force about the whole project. And then, you know, trying to engage some, you know, other local artists like Evelyn Perry, who is our director, She's also a Toronto transplant, previous Buddies in Bad Times theater artistic director, absolute creative force, who relocated here to do her master's at Queen's. So we just, you know, we tried to kind of build a team kind of to celebrate these folks living in Eastern Ontario. And we've got some other people that we pulled in from other parts of Canada as well. But yeah, the idea was, can we do a professional play premiere here in Kingston? Why not? So there you go.
Awesome. Yeah. And I was also wondering if you could speak to just the aspect of doing a one person show. Like, that sounds very challenging. And have you done anything like this before?
I haven't. I've never written a solo show. And it's very different, because I think the part that I really love as a playwright is like the dialogue. And that's the part that I always find really fun to write. So it did take some mind bending for me to kind of figure out, how does a solo show work and how do I write in that singular voice? There are moments where Zoe inhabits other characters and we hear other characters speak, but for the most part, it's her kind of narrating things to the audience. I really am a big fan of Fleabag. I'm not sure if you've seen that, but it was originally a play and she talks right to the audience. So that was something that I used to kind of help me a little bit get inspired. But it was definitely a learning curve for me. And what we found in rehearsal is many lines that I wrote in terms of the narration can actually be acted. So in a lot of moments in rehearsal, we've just been like scratching things out. Ah, we don't need this, because Zoe's able to fill in so many of the blanks. So it's been a cool process for me, and definitely a challenge. And God bless Zoe Sweet, because she is rocking out 56 pages of text. It's a lot. It's a marathon. So, but she's doing amazing.
Awesome stuff. And she'll be doing those 56 pages for a few nights coming up. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about the premiere and how folks can come watch.
Totally. So we preview the show on Thursday the 19th and opening is on Friday the 20th. And we run until Sunday, September the 29th. Tickets are available on the Grand Theatre's website. The easiest thing to do is just type in "Why It's Possible Grand Theatre Kingston" or go onto our social media pages. We are Fab and Sweet Collective. That's or Sweet and Fab, I should say, pardon me. Zoe's last name and my name last name. So Sweet and Fab Collective on Instagram. And there's a link in our bio there too.
Once again, that was Sophia Fabili on her show, Why It's Possible, premiering at the Kingston Grand Theatre tonight and showing through to September 29th. After my chat with Sophia, I also sat down with director Evelyn Perry to dive a bit deeper into the show. Here's our conversation.
I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the beginnings of this show during COVID, up until now, working with the three of you as a team.
The original team had another director on board, Sarah Kitts, who's now the artistic director at the Great Canadian Theatre Company in Ottawa. So she got that job sometime after she was living in Kingston when Sophia and Zoe and her started to work on the project. So I actually have been involved for about a year. I've definitely been involved in like the last layer of dramaturgical editing and thinking about the story. But yeah, there is that other collaborator, Sarah, who would have directed had she not got the job at GCTC and left the city to do that. So I'm a relative newcomer to the area. I'm from Toronto. Mm-hmm. And I came to Queens to do my MA in cultural studies. So I've been in the neighborhood and I knew Zoe, the performer from Toronto, and they reached out to me. So it's been a very collaborative process, but I haven't actually been a collaborator since the beginning.
I mean, that's really interesting though, that all three of you, I think, are Toronto transplants.
Yeah.
Or Sophia was saying yesterday, why can't we premiere a film in Kingston? Why does it have to be Toronto or Montreal? And I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that.
Yeah, I think it's really an exciting part of when Zoe and Sophia came to me to invite me in. Yeah, they were very clear about that kind of idea of trying to make something that's really speaking to the community, that it's like that it's of and for the community where it's produced. And this story, it feels like, you know, it's a very timely story, this story that's dealing with trans identity and gender and parenting. And I worked for a long time at Buddies in Bad Times Theatre in Toronto, which is a large queer theatre company. And so all of the work that we were doing, I was always, you know, both curating and making and in dialogue about work that was on a big variety of queer themes. And so this seemed to me a really interesting project for its particular perspective. And I'm always looking, as a theater person, I'm always interested in like a perspective I haven't seen on stage before, something that seems like a new angle to consider, a new way into to a narrative or an idea. And this project really struck me as that. I thought the idea of exploring parenting, especially at this moment where the issue of trans kids and gender non-binary kids and like a very young generation we're in a moment of big social change, and this issue has become so politicized and like has been turned into a wedge issue in politics and has come to represent something even larger than it is, in fact. Anyway, it seemed the angle of being a parent to a young kid who's going through this and a parent trying to navigate not only their relationship with their kid, but their relationship with their parent. So it becomes an intergenerational story. Felt very resonant, very timely to, you know, things that we're hearing about in the news and things that are affecting political campaigns and also are really like damaging a lot of people's lives. And this is a long-winded answer to your question about being Toronto transplants, but I guess I say it because it feels exciting to be doing something outside of a city where, you know, the kind of, I think Kingston is a wonderful community for feeling like a very queer positive and queer friendly place to be. And I love that about it as a newcomer. And the kind of conversations around queerness and gender and stuff are always in Toronto. It feels like there's a particular kind of conversation that goes on there that's different than places outside of Toronto. So for me, I was curious about what would it be like to have this conversation outside of Toronto, because I've had it inside Toronto for a long time. And I know some of the challenges and opportunities inside of that. But for me, this was a new, you know, it's a chance to make theater with some other folks who are adventurous and ambitious and like looking to do something that's trying to push in some way, push the boundaries in terms of form. I think it's quite interesting, formal, like the way this show is written is quite interesting. So this combination of things of like meeting with some other folks who are, you know, have spent their lots of their careers in Toronto, but have now wound up in Kingston and trying to make something that makes all of us excited and that we don't feel we've quite seen on stage before. All of that seemed like an interesting opportunity. So we're excited to test it out, as one does, right? In theater, it's like it exists in your imagination until it hits the audience for the first time. And then you start to understand more about it when it's actually in dialogue with a live audience.
Yeah, absolutely. What are you kind of hoping that audiences will be able to take away from it after it premieres on Friday?
I'm more curious about what they will take away. But I guess I'll say that something that I love about the script is that it's really funny, as well as really emotional. And it feels like it has a wide range of... I hope that it's really going to take people on a journey. So I'm hoping people will like have some really good laughs as well as some really big feels in their hearts. Yeah, I'd say that.
Awesome. Yeah. And I was wondering, you were talking about the form there. How is it directing a one-person show? Have you ever done that before? Is this kind of new territory for you?
No, I've actually done quite a lot of work with one-person shows. So it's a particular kind of challenge and a particular kind of fun. Obviously, the challenge is, first of all, just the sort of technical and energetic, like, challenge it is for an actor to, you know, hold the stage for an hour and 20 minutes of a monologue, essentially, and to kind of contain... Like you don't have a chance to step off stage. Nobody, no scene partners are coming to like remind you of what's next or to give you energy. So the performer is very much in the audience kind of becomes a real playing partner for a one person show. And I think that's an exciting dynamic of it. And in this case, as with any one person shows, like there's lots of different characters that are in the story. So it's a really wonderful challenge for an actor to sink their teeth into, is like how to represent multiple characters. And then another thing that happens in this show is like quite a bit of dialogue with those other characters and the main character. So how do you stage that sort of dialogue? And in the case of this show, there's a kind of storytelling format to it as well. So we're just experimenting with like, how do you contain a long story that takes many twists and turns and kind of calls back to different points in time? And how do you keep things clear and moving forward and all these characters at play? Like, anyway, there's lots of fun challenges inside of it. We have some wonderful design collaborators on this, and I hope that the staging itself gives a lot of layers of meaning, the way that the stage is designed and the way that we're using that stage in terms of the movement and the lighting and all those little choices that all add up to like give a lot of information.
Yeah, for sure. And how are you feeling leading up to the premiere on Friday?
It always comes up faster than you want it to, but I'm feeling great. I'm feeling excited. And like I said, it's like the moment when the show meets the audience is always slightly terrifying, but also really why you do it at the end of the day. It's like, so I think we're all excited for the show to meet people.
That was director Evelyn Perry of Why It's Possible, premiering tonight at the Kingston Grand Theatre.
That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Everything I want.
All right, that's life.